Between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, thousands of African Americans were lynched and dozens of communities devastated in race riots. The causes of that nationwide, decades-long reign of terror and the best way to fight the beliefs which motivated it are still debated. One of the last of these incidents, and one of the hardest to explain, occurred near Dallas in northeast Texas, Grayson County.
Prior to 1930, it was delightful to be a black person in Sherman.
William Hill of Sherman, Texas.
You didn't get much for your work and anything, but all of the black people had a lot of pride and they wanted to develop themselves.
By 1930, black and white had reached a kind of rough, separate, though sometimes brutal, societal balance. Black Dallas included the Deep Ellum Music District, while White Dallas broadcast the nation's first barn dance radio program.
How do you feel, Prince?
Feel like a jug of molasses. All around but not stuck up.
And while both races were suffering the Great Depression, blacks had to struggle to keep even the lowest paid jobs.
We built a new school here.
College graduate Alexander Bate.
And every book, and desk, and everything was used when they put in the new school. Nothing new in it.
My name is Donna Kumler. I'm an historian, and I interviewed Bate and Hill and other witnesses to the event that changed their lives in Sherman more than 50 years later.
Sometimes the Ku Klux Klan would have a parade, and we'd get in the car and drive up to where we could see them.
It was just a few years after nationwide Klan membership had soared into the millions, but still, Hill's family didn't take the Klan too seriously.
You could recognize them by the bill, you know, such as the banker. We would sit in the car, and I've often heard my mother and sisters and others say, well, there goes Mr. So-and-so, and there's Mr. So-and-so, and look who's in there, there's so-and-so.
Like that banker, blacks shared in Sherman's prosperity with their own three-block commercial district.
They had a good Negro business, big building there, called Andrews Auditorium.
They had the restaurant, they had the tailor shop, upstairs they had the motion picture, and the medical doctor, dentist, downstairs was the drugstore, and was it Masonic, or maybe it was the Knights of Pythian, large hall.
A grocery store, a pool hall, a restaurant, and a barbershop, and a barbershop, and a barbershop. They had about three bathtubs, you know. We didn't have no more than conveniences, so people could go in there and take a bath in the bathtub. Then they had a pool hall in the bottom and the theater at the top, and they gave the big bands dances.
But much of that came to an end soon after May 3rd, 1930. The newspapers of Sunday, May 4th reported, Negro held for assault near Luella. One Mrs. Pearl Farlow, a white woman, had allegedly been tied to her bed and raped by a black farm laborer named George Hughes.
We didn't know anything. Nobody in Sherman knew him. I don't know. I mean, black folks didn't know anything about him. Somebody just drifting through, I understood. They said he was just a kind of a loafing man coming through town.
This account in the paper said this Hughes fellow had worked for these people on the farm. Mm-hmm. And when he went for his money, she told him her husband had gone to town and she couldn't pay him until he came back. And when he went back, he wasn't there, so he went in and raped her.
Rape was then the most frequent reason given for lynching. But the Commission on Interracial Cooperation, then the South's leading liberal, or rather, racially moderate group, had concluded that it reflected a phobia, not the facts. Sociologist Arthur Raper.
We had done the research on why people got lynched. Most of it was not for sex or sex-related crime. As reported by the white newspapers, it was mostly economic and etiquette matters. There was just an assumption in some areas that you had to have a lynching every now and then to preserve equitable race relations.
The explanation accepted by many Negroes locally was that Hughes went to his employer's house asking for his wages, and that the employer, being unwilling to pay him, had his wife to report that she'd been assaulted.
A reading from Raper's 1933 book, The Tragedy of Lynching, based on an investigation by the Southern Commission for the Study of Lynching.
I don't know, she and her husband have been having some problems.
Alexander Bate.
She brought this big scare up, and they got after the shot at him, and that kind of thing, and got him.
Hughes was not openly accused of the assault until after he'd been in jail for 2 days.
In the Dallas County Jail.
While Hughes was being held, a white mob tried to break into the jail.
No one will go your bail.
It is almost unanimously reported that Hughes was mentally unstable, some saying that he was crazy, others that he had spells. The county attorney maintained that it is damn foolishness to claim that Hughes was feeble-minded. He has as much sense as any nigger, just a damn beast who knew what he wanted and meant to have it, held and hanging, notwithstanding.
Monday's Sherman Daily Democrat was headlined, Quick Trial Promised for Negro.
Exaggerated versions of the crime were widespread. It was reported that the Negro not only had raped the woman 3 times in succession, but that he had mutilated her throat and breast and that he was diseased.
After that said it wasn't true, that he chewed her breast on her breast and all that. Kind of anything to arouse the mob rule, you know.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People had been fighting mobs by trying for 15 years to force a national anti-lynching bill through a reluctant Congress. Southern leaders stopped them by filibuster, that is, talking the bill to death. They promised instead to keep blacks safe from vigilantes and protect white women by dealing with rape suspects legally and swiftly.
On Thursday the 8th, just 5 days after the alleged attack, authorities brought suspect Hughes to Grayson County's landmark 2-story brick courthouse in Sherman. Hughes pleaded guilty. He was brought back the next morning for trial in chains. The accuser, Mrs. Farlow, was brought in on a stretcher. By noon, the jury had been selected.
It had been raining for several days, and for weeks the ground had been too wet to work. A case like that against Hughes always attracts a large crowd. The continued rains, leaving farmers with little to do, resulted in an unusually large crowd.
From sociologist Arthur Raper's The Tragedy of Lynching.
Trouble in mind and blue.
As William Hill recalled,
all I remember was the many cars that came into the city and the streets full of people. My mother called the school and told them to send me home and tell me not to go through town. So the school was dismissed early that day.
Boy, they was going around that courthouse with sticks and marching around and hollering and going home.
Alexander Bate.
We had a whole lot of people in Sherman that participated in it. And a whole lot of people come from Mississippi, Alabama, and all around the herd.
Cars were just coming in, droves from Oklahoma, and I guess they were hungry for something to do, and they came in to join in. You know, people like a disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
Some do, and of course, I think they were just with nothing to do in a small town. They just thought they'd stir up something.
The crowd, reportedly egged on by an out-of-town woman, forced their way into the courthouse. Local officials, reinforced by 4 Texas Rangers, tried to keep them out of the courtroom with tear gas and buckshot. By 2 o'clock, the crowd had broken many courthouse windows. And around 2:30, 2 teenage boys, reportedly, threw a can of gasoline and a lighted match through one of those broken windows. As the courthouse burned, the lawmen hustled the jury, the victim, and others down ladders to safety. The accused man, Hughes, they locked into the building's fireproof steel and concrete vault.
And we could see from my classroom, we could see the papers burning, the smoke and the blaze coming over. We could look out several blocks away to the highway going into Denison, and we could see colored people with sacks and things going down the road, just scared to death.
We could look over from Denison and see this enormous cloud of smoke.
17-year-old Ralph Elliott and his friend Hewlin Johnson were on school break.
And we had heard that there was a large crowd in Sherman and much excitement, so we decided.
The 2 white teenagers hitched a ride.
We got to Sherman around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and there we saw an enormous crowd that extended throughout all of the square area, standing room only, and extended up some of the streets adjacent to the courthouse.
The Dallas News reported the handful of Rangers retreated from Sherman about this time.
They were putting out extras, it seemed like, about every 10 minutes, and newsboys would hawk those papers through the crowds. the fire department would string their hoses through the crowd, and they would no sooner get the hose there than someone back in the crowd would chop the hose in two, and it would go writhing through the air like some giant serpent.
By 4 o'clock, the courthouse was gutted.
The fire and everything.
And as daylight began to fade, 55 soldiers arrived with machine guns and tear gas bombs. Ralph Elliott.
The Texas National Guard appeared on the courthouse square and endeavored to push the crowd back by taking their rifles and turning them sideways and shoving it forward. And I remember distinctly there was a nice-looking gentleman, short, stocky man in a blue serge suit and a white sailor straw hat. The young soldier kept hitting this man in the breast with a gun, and the man warned him 2 or 3 times not to do that anymore. And at about that time, the man turned to me and said, "Hold my hat." And he tore into the soldier and put him on the ground, and if that were sort of a signal, everyone else started assaulting the soldiers too.
Urged on, reportedly, by women screaming at the yellow, nigger-loving soldiers.
And the guard began a retreat backwards. They were throwing rocks and bricks and clubs, wood, through the air, falling on the soldiers as they retreated. Many of them were knocked out or unconscious.
The guardsmen fell back on the town jail.
About that time, Hewlin and I thought we detected a shot that had hit the automobile that we were behind, and we decided that we had better not go any further. Right in that area, there was a bakery. Of course, the smell of baking bread is almost sure to excite the appetite of anyone, I think. And so we stopped and bought us a loaf of bread and ate it.
But Hill and Bate and African Americans nationwide knew that this was probably just a brief lull. The newspapers and the grapevine were loaded with stories about mobs targeting Negro businesses and property. Experts, white supremacists, and anti-lynching activists agreed the rioters' goal was to keep blacks in their place.
I suppose it must have been 10 or 11 o'clock. Someone knocked on our door, and it was the principal of the school, his wife, and one of the doctor's wives. They spent the night, and some of their men went back to protect their homes with water holes and various things.
I was back here on top of the house with a bucket of water and a shotgun. And I didn't have about 4 shells. During those times, you didn't have no money to buy shells with. And my dad was walking in front of the house, and he had a pistol, about 3220. And everybody on that street left but me and Papa. So he said, "Son, we're going to stay here and protect what we got."
Night had fallen.
A portion of the courthouse was still upright. The rest of it had all disintegrated into rubble and brick. The windows were all burnt out, but the shell was still standing. But on the south side, you could see the vault. And the lights, great lights somewhere came. The lights were very large. It was fully illuminated. You could see everything they were doing, just like a movie.
You could see everything even into the night.
Half a dozen or so men would go up the side of the courthouse and inspect the door of the vault. They said, "We need some crowbars." Next thing I knew, crowbars would show up. Then they wanted dynamite. And someone in there must have known how to use dynamite, because they then set dynamite off.
They blow up that vault.
They would come down and the crowd would all fall back and the blast would go off. They would climb up again, could not get the door open. This went on for some period of time, and they needed a acetylene torch. And right away, just a short period of time, here they'd show up with torch. And when they had completed burning through, they took hammers and bolts and bars and tried to beat on it, but could never do any good. So they called for more dynamite. The crowd fell back and the dynamite went off, and it blew the cutout piece into the vault.
And they think the joke killed him.
It was just before midnight.
Well, I remember a great deal of smoke came out of the vault. Then they wanted flashlights, and flashlights appeared, and finally one of them crawled through the opening. Presently, they threw the body of this black man out this hole, and he hit the ground nearly in front of Hewlett and I. And when he came out the window, the crowd let out a great roar and cry, you know, hoorah or hooray. Almost instantly, someone tied this chain around him, carried him out to the curb. They attached his body to the back end of this Model T Ford and took off. And I remember his body bouncing behind that car. And of course, as he went by, the crowd would spit and attempt to kick him, all this sort of thing.
The crowd that followed Hughes' body was estimated at 2,000 strong.
And they passed the street right here, and it was level from one side to the other. Pregnant women following this pregnant man down this street here.
The crowd built a fire in front of the Black Business District's drugstore.
There's a tree out there, and they hung him up in the tree.
Hanging by the chain from the limb of the tree, and there's very hot fire going beneath him. His feet and his hands were... His wrists were turned up as though he was trying to reach his elbow or something in that twisted position.
The crowd looted and torched the Black Business District as Hughes' body roasted.
Oh, my Lord, what shall I do?
The black owner of one business was luckier than most.
Dr. Goodson had one fellow that worked for him that looked like a white man. He was a mulatto man, and he went in, got the money out, and he came on out and walked around in the crowd, through the crowd, and they didn't recognize him as being a Negro. Mm-hmm.
But that may have been the only money Sherman's blacks ever got out of the wreckage. William Hill later told me.
He never did try to rebuild.
So, for all practical purposes, the business district was gone.
It was gone.
And it never has been reestablished.
No. You know, this Andrews building, I think the insurance didn't pay them.
I ain't got so many matches, but I got so far to go.
While the Black Business District burned, whites dispersed to carry the fire into black neighborhoods where residents like William Bate and his father were waiting.
Some guys came down there in an old Chevrolet and jumped out the Masonic Hall there with a gasoline can. I told them, get the hell out of there. They saw that big 3229. They jumped in that Chevrolet. I guess they broke every spring in it.
Then a chemistry professor of ours, Professor Brouse, wanted to go. So we all went back and got in his automobile and came on home. As we were coming, that was a colored area. And so I saw an old black gentleman sitting on his porch with a shotgun across his lap. Nobody bothered him. That's about all I remember of that incident.
Ralph Elliott later became a lawyer and a judge. His companion, Hewlin Johnson, became a minister. William Hill.
The next day when the state troopers arrived, my things began to settle again.
Hill stayed in Sherman and became a school teacher.
The town was put under a court martial, and you had to be off the streets at a certain time.
Martial law and the curfew lasted for 2 weeks. The state's investigation, less than a week after the riot, blamed the destruction on Reds, Bolsheviks, and Sovietism, mentioned hoodlums and criminals, and denied the trouble had anything to do with race prejudice.
Still, there's an unavoidable question. Why? When the accused black rapist had already pleaded guilty and there could be so little doubt about his fate, why had these whites rioted?
During the days preceding the trial, Slim Jones rode throughout the rural sections.
From Arthur Raper's The Tragedy of Lynching.
Some felt that Jones was the oral agent for a senile Klan organization, which was making this last effort to demonstrate its importance. The uncertainty of employment and the slump of farming embittered the propertyless whites, who openly begrudged the Negro any evidence of accumulated savings or of regular employment.
But if their motive was economic, why did the rioters do so much damage to Sherman? Why did they burn down their fine courthouse, the centerpiece of the county seat? Why did they attack their own Texas Rangers and National Guard troops? Some, including a contemporary Texas newsman, argue their behavior was a result of their upbringing.
Boys grow to manhood with the idea that lynch law is right and proper and worthy of applause, and they follow the example set them by their fathers.
From an editorial in an 1893 Waco newspaper quoted by historian William Carrigan. In his book, The Making of a Lynching Culture, Violence and Vigilantism in Central Texas, Carrigan points out,
the individuals that were honored in Central Texas were Indian fighters and soldiers who fought against Mexico and Confederate soldiers and members of the Ku Klux Klan. The streets were named after them. They were elected to the office. Glowing obituaries written, monuments erected, placards placed.
Arthur Raper put it another way.
Texas and Oklahoma, it's just a different kind of a world. Mm-hmm. A lot of lawlessness and braggadocio and bigness. Texas is the frontier. Texas does have its rowdies. Texas is bombast. Mm-hmm. If you can lie and if you can brag and tell the truth, brag, says the Texan. If you can't, well, brag anyhow.
The Sherman grand jury charged just 14 of the 72 whites and one black who'd been arrested and jailed briefly for questioning. One received a 2-year sentence, and the rest had all charges dismissed.
Professor Carrigan recalls a similar, notorious case which had occurred nearby 14 years before.
In 1916, a young black man, 17 or 18 years old, named Jesse Washington, was taken from the courthouse during the middle of his trial in Waco, Texas, and dragged, beat, castrated, and eventually placed in the city public square in front of the courthouse and burned alive before a mob that was estimated at 15,000 people.
Despite national headlines about the Waco horror and the NAACP's anti-lynching campaign, no member of the Waco lynch mob was prosecuted, and some looked beyond society for justice.
In 1953, a deadly tornado struck Waco's downtown.
My mother made all four of us, the children, get in bed, fully dressed, shoes and all, in her bed. And she said, God is fixing the work, so you all be quiet.
Mary Denkins was 11 years old at the time.
And I'll never forget, we were home exactly 15 minutes and the tornado hit.
Killed 114 people, did $51 million of property damage.
It was 37 years, almost to the day, after the Jesse Washington lynching.
African Americans in Waco chose to believe the tornado was sent by God to punish white Waco for its transgressions.
I remember my grandparents and my parents telling me the way they lynched Jesse Washington and drug his body around the square. That was exactly the way the tornado came, and it destroyed Waco.
Under slavery and Jim Crow segregation alike, blacks had fallen back on their faith, looking to a Christian God for the justice that white society denied them.
In Sherman, Alexander Bate and his wife Peachy told me that some rioters met their just desserts.
I couldn't identify them.
You know, they
didn't see them
for maybe something would happen to somebody. They said he was in the mob.
Yeah, something drastic would have happened.
Kind of thing,
the guy,
but you didn't know.
That had a violent, and a lot of these people, they said that they had violent death. One guy, he went out there swimming. He was a real smart guy in town, and he was a kind of an engineer, mechanic. He's the one who took the torch and went up there and cut him out of it. And he's dead. He got drowned.
I see the sign of the judgment.
And for some, even today, logic alone can't explain lynching. Racial violence during that time had a community ritual side that went far beyond reason. Historian John Bracey.
One instance that always strikes me is where this white circus audience lynches an elephant. Because the elephant reared up during a performance and it killed the white trainer, the audience opened fire on the elephant. The elephant didn't die. They took the elephant out, carried it onto a flatbed truck, took it down to a railway trestle, and lynched the elephant. because the elephant had offended a white man.
This allegedly took place in Tennessee around 1922, says Bracey.
There's a level of irrationality and kind of pathology during the age of Jim Crow that can't always be reduced to economic circumstances or reduced to some sort of one-on-one correlation with cotton prices.
Bracey is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
And the place where you need for Freud to reach out his hand to Marx and Marx to reach out his hand to Freud is when you confront the Negro question.
Lynching was a kind of madness, says Bracey. The ancient Greeks believed such madness was sent by the gods. Sociologist Arthur Raper believed reason and public exposure could end the madness.
You've got to prevent lynchings with facts about why people lynch. People would know it could be more rational. See, the irrationality quotient in the lynching phenomenon was tremendous.
Just a month after the Sherman riot, Raper's group organized their study of lynching and used pamphlets and press releases to pressure officials, politicians, and the media. But Ida B. Wells and other black leaders had been publicizing the facts about lynching and rape for decades, and it hadn't ended the terror. Although by 1930, annual lynchings had declined from hundreds to a handful. So now, the Interracial Commission confronted the myth head on.
And of course, the women then came in and played a tremendous role there.
Arthur Riper.
Mrs. Ames organized these very strong church women's associations, and particularly the core of it was the Methodist women.
Texan Jesse Daniel Ames was the leader of women's work for the Interracial Council. Just 6 months after the Sherman riot, she formed the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching.
What these women have done, they have signed that they're going to prevent lynchings in any and every way they can. And that they're going to call on the sheriffs, and they're going to call on the police, and they're going to call on the judges, and they're going to be active in this thing. And by gracious, they were.
Unfortunately, no recordings of Jesse Daniel Ames herself seem to have survived.
And they're going to tell the politicians, lynchings don't protect our virtue. We don't need anybody to protect our virtue. And if you get up in Congress of the United States and say that you're lynching to preserve our virtue, we're going to call you down. Now, don't you do it. And all of this filibustering, that's full of that stuff, up till 1930 and 31, dropped out.
The women's voices were very effective, Raper recalls, in fighting the beliefs which motivated lynchers and their supporters.
And it simply wasn't respectable to use the protection of Southern white women as a defense for lynching anymore. Mm-hmm.
And lynching, the nationwide terror that had killed thousands and affected generations of Americans, went into its final, perhaps, decline. With Donna Kumler of Grayson County College, I'm Alan Lipke of Listening Between the Lines. Lynching's End is written, produced, and directed by Alan Lipke, with research by Donna Kumler and Alan Lipke. Script edited by Celeste Headley. Readings by Leroy Mitchell. Music by Jabbo Smith and his Rhythm Aces, Alfred Snuff Johnson, Gene Autry, Bob Wills, Leadbelly, Memphis Slim, Prince Albert Hunt's Texas Ramblers, Blind Willie Johnson, Blind Lemon Jefferson, Rudy Vallee, and Milton Brown and his musical Brownings. Additional documentaries about the U.S. between Civil War and Civil Rights are available at www.racewithhistory.org. Thanks to the University of North Texas, Rowan Radio WGLS 89.7, WMNF 88.5 FM, the Southern Oral History Program, Alan Governor and Documentary Arts, Rebecca Sharpless, Jacqueline Dowd Hall, Robert Zangrando, Cliff Kuhn, and William Carrigan. Pacifica Station, KPFT FM 90.1 of Houston, Texas, sponsored and originally broadcast this program, which is made possible in part by grants from Humanities Texas, the state partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. For information, additional programs, and a discussion guide, please visit www.racewithhistory.org. That's race with history, with only one H, .org.